Great. Well, thanks very much to Anne-Marie and Bob for the opportunity to speak, and also for lining up a great meeting. I think there's a fantastic lineup of talks over the next couple of days. What I'd like to do this afternoon is give you a progress report on some experiments we've been doing in my lab, looking at sort of cellular-level changes in the accessory olfactory bulb after social learning. So the main focus of my lab overall is just to understand, you know, how is properties of the sensory world encoded neural activity patterns in the brain, and also, you know, how are these changed with experience in order to guide future behaviors? So for a number of reasons, the AOB turns out to be a really nice system to look at this, and we're finally starting to sort of unravel, I think, some of the underlying cellular-level mechanisms. Okay, so I think for this crowd and at this point, we really don't need much introduction for the vomeronasal system. So of course, we have this little sac of receptors sitting in the roof of the mouth, acting in parallel to the main olfactory system, projecting to this tiny region at the back of the bulb that plays sort of an outsized behavioral role. So this system is dedicated to detecting, as you know, sort of high molecular weight or maybe charged compounds, which carry a lot of social significance for animals, which is, of course, the reason that they, you know, your pets make a beeline for each other. As soon as they find somebody else that they're interested in, the first thing they do is stick their nose in a place that most of us would consider quite rude. So the reason they do this so enthusiastically is because a lot of these areas secrete either, you know, peptidergic or high molecular weight compounds, again, that carry really meaningful information about social status, individual identity, sort of dominance, and so on. So of course, this is sort of a barcode that represents the identity of the individual, or at least in our case, with the inbred animals that we work with, for the strain that we use as a proxy for individuals. So of course, these sort of unique complements of chemo signals create a unique pattern of neural activity in the accessory olfactory bulb that represents that specific individual. And these, of course, then this activity is relayed to downstream structures, you know, the stria terminalis, the amygdala, and from there on to the hypothalamus. So as you can see, all the sort of interesting and fun action is that sort of at the front and the bottom of the brain. And these regions are really strong, play a strong role in influencing sort of social, reproductive, and aggressive behaviors, and so on. So, you know, the AOB and the vomeronasal system, I guess, is most commonly associated with sort of stereotyped and hardwired behaviors. But of course, if all you had to work with there was a set of fixed action patterns, then things would sort of be a little boring and not perhaps as adaptive as they could be. So there's a lot of context in which experience can act on this system in order to modify its output as well. So that's what we were interested in asking. Probably the most striking example of this is the Bruce effect, discovered by Hilda Bruce way back in the sort of late 50s, early 60s. So the basics of the phenomenon, which you're probably familiar with, is that the default state for a female mouse is that after she mates with a male, and for the 72 hours before the embryo implants, if she's exposed to the pheromones of an unfamiliar male, then the activity generated in the AOB drives a set of sort of neuroendocrine changes that prevent the implantation and block pregnancy. For the stud male in particular, if she, after mating, is allowed to imprint on his complement of pheromones, then if she's exposed to his chemo signals, then pregnancy still proceeds. Right? So there's something about this imprinting process that leads to a specific change in the AOB in the neural activity patterns that are generated by his pheromones that lead to a sort of a change in the physiological outcome of the sensory exposure. So this phenomenon, at least sort of signatures of this phenomenon, have shown up in a number of different species, including these Galatas, old world primates, where, you know, in this case, these guys live in troops, and after a new male invades and takes over the troop of females, then the first thing that happens is the females abort their pregnancies as well. So in this case, we don't really know that it's a chemo signal-derived phenomenon, but nonetheless, this appears to be widespread across a number of different species. Okay. So I don't know that there's any evidence for pregnancy block in human females, but nonetheless, the consequences of forgetting can be sort of equally dire. All right. So this is the neural phenomenon that we'd really like to understand is, you know, what are the nature of the changes that take place during imprinting and how do they change the neural representation of the pheromones of the stud male? So lucky for us, there's been several decades of work on this topic actually, and they've led to this model, which is actually a little more background. It's been established that this phenomenon is localized at least in part in the AOB, that it depends on neuromodulator release, specifically noradrenaline has been strongly implicated, and it also leads to a change in the relative amounts of GABA release, right? So inhibitory circuits have been very strongly implicated. So the model that this has led to is that the sensory stimulus or the pattern of neural activity triggered by this stud male after mating, inhibitory circuits are upregulated specifically for the neurons that represent the stud male. And therefore, they block the output of those neurons that represent this guy so that his pheromones no longer trigger the pregnancy block. So this was the model that was in place that we wanted to test. And you know, so despite all the work in this topic, we felt that there was really not a lot of sort of measurements of the cellular synaptic basis of this phenomenon that would, and especially this idea of cellular specificity. So this is what we set out to test. The first thing we realized when we started looking at this problem is we really had a kind of a poor idea of what inhibition in the circuit was doing to start with. So it seems particularly well poised to strongly regulate AOB output. So if you look at your sort of classic cortical or hippocampal circuits, then you see again one and say five cells as inhibitory. If you look in the olfactory bulb, the numbers are flipped, so you have sort of on the order of magnitude more inhibitory neurons than projection neurons. And you can imagine them doing a number of things. So the classic sort of idea in the olfactory bulb is lateral inhibition, where different sensory channels interact with each other. Or you could also have this sort of global effect of scaling of the total amount of activity. You could reduce the similarity in firing patterns of different neurons. But you know, in the AOB, I think it's fair to say that we still don't quite understand the operating principles for inhibition. So the experiment that we started doing first was just to cut a slice of the AOB, record from microcells, inject current to drive trains of action potentials in these cells, recruit the granule cells, which then feed back on these neurons through these reciprocal dendritic synapses, and see what we could see. So here's a neuron in the AOB, a mitral cell filled with dye, reconstructed after a recording. Here's a current injection, the cell's firing some spikes, and we have really have very little signature of synaptic inhibition that's being evoked. So we tried some other paradigms, you know, driving rapid bursts of spikes, ways that this has been explored in the main olfactory bulb, and we found that we could recruit some inhibition, but not to the level that we sort of expected in order to be able to really suppress the output of the AOB. So after puzzling over this for maybe longer than I really want to tell you about, we came up with the idea that when we looked at our old data from my former colleague Minmin, who made some of the only existing recordings of AOB responses in behaving animals, we realized that the time scale that this system operates on is really quite different. So the cells tend to be active for tens of seconds at a time. So when we matched our stimulus more to this time scale, we found that the firing patterns of the cells started to display some interesting characteristics. Right? So they would go up and fire very rapidly initially, but then they would fall off quite dramatically in many cases over time. And this coincided with the emergence of some really robust IPSPs. Right? So these cells were generating massive amounts of self-inhibition that looked like it was acting to reduce their firing late in the train. Now, this was a really sort of unexpected level of inhibition, and just as a reality check, we also recorded from some cells in the main olfactory bulb, and we found that there's under the same recording conditions, the same slice and so on, we were virtually unable to drive the same amount of inhibition. So this sort of self, this massive amount of self-inhibition that we see in the AOB really seems to be unique to that circuit. Again, we wanted to show whether or not this actually was regulating the output of these neurons. So we blocked inhibition, and at least, you know, these cells have some really unusual characteristics, but for the subset of cells for which we could do this experiment, we found that blocking inhibition really substantially increased the output of these cells. Okay, so where does this get us to now? So I think we can say, you know, for one thing, that the role of synaptic inhibition regulating the output of the AOB is very strong. It emerges slowly, and importantly for this model that we started out looking at, individual neurons on their own are able to recruit this inhibition in a way that can suppress their own output. Okay, so it seemed like we had at least the basic ingredients that were sort of matching this model we set out to test. And when we looked at different neurons, also when we, you know, used this long stimulus, we found that there was a really sort of diverse set of firing properties. So some cells decayed a little bit, some a little bit more, some really dramatically. So if you're an optimist, which I try and do sort of once a month or so, whether I need it or not, you can imagine that maybe these properties depend somehow on the history of sensory experience in these animals. All right, so this, then we finally had a, let's say, a signature that we wanted to look at and see if this is modified by sensory learning that takes place during mating. All right, so this is our, I guess, acid test experiment. So now we actually needed to control the timing of mating relative to slice preparation quite tightly. So what we did was we over-ectomized the animals, clamped their ester cycle with a capsule of estradiol, induced estrus with progesterone injection, and then we put the animals together once the female hit estrus, put them together for 4 or 5 hours, after which we cut slices and evaluated, again, the role of inhibition in the circuit. So I wanted to give you a quick look of, so we also video recorded these animals. Oops. So I want to give you a quick look at sort of what happens, you know, both during mating, but also during the period after mating. Right, so this is sped up, you know, sort of 8 times or so, and you know, sort of biology has just taken its course. So down here we've got a color-coded chart that shows the behavior of the animals kicking in right about here. So the gold indicates sort of mounting and mating behavior. And then the cyan color indicates when the animals are actually in contact and, you know, presumably driving sensory activation in the system. Right, so what I'd really like you to notice is that, you know, like a lot of the relationships with some of my friends, the male and the female sort of come apart and come back together again, and they do this again and again over a fairly extended period of time. So the system is really driven repetitively, and if you could hold on to that thought for later, that would be great. Right, so we had our paradigm for presumably inducing plasticity in the system. So then again, we wanted to look at potential changes in inhibition. So we did the simplest possible experiment to start out with, which was just to suppress activity in the slice with TTX and record miniature iPSCs in mitral cells. So we found, you know, there's sort of a baseline level of activity in both naive and sensory-exposed animals, but when we looked at animals from the mated group, then there was a really substantial increase in the frequency of GABA release, but very little change in the amplitude of these events. So initially, it looks like plasticity is acting on either, you know, the probability of GABA release or the number of release sites in the granule cells, but not so much on receptors in the mitral cells. So we also recorded from granule cells, you know, the local interneurons that are presumed to provide this feedback inhibition, and we saw similar effects. So in this case, we saw, recording now in current clamp mode, we saw an increase in both the frequency and in the amplitude of excitatory events onto the interneurons. All right, so if we sum all these up, so now we've got a sort of a distributed set of, you know, sites in the pathway for generating feedback inhibition that are modified by mating. So we've got both, you know, release from the interneurons and from the projection neurons, and also an increase in the sensitivity to transmitter release in the interneurons. So all these, in theory, would act to sort of augment the total levels of inhibition that are present in the circuit. So all this so far really sort of matched up with the predictions of this model, which was nice. But on the other hand, it gets a little bit boring because somebody has a model and you test predictions and they come out right, and that's somehow a little bit dissatisfying. So we also tested a couple other properties of these cells, which was to, in this case, looking at granule cells, we injected increasing amounts of current to drive firing in these cells, and we found that actually the intrinsic excitability of the interneurons is also upregulated after mating. Right, so not only synaptic changes are driven by plasticity in the circuit, but also, you know, the intrinsic excitability of the neurons has changed. In this case, in the granule cells, it seems to be responsible, it seems to be due to primarily a change in the resting membrane potential of the cells. Okay. Right, so now we've got a set of changes in local inhibition that are driven by mating, and we wanted to go back and test one of the central predictions of this model, which was that plasticity is going to be specific to the neurons that are activated by mating. So this is, I neglected to tell you before now, that we actually did these recordings in an ARC-GFP line where the neurons activated during mating express activity-dependent GFP. So these, this is actually interneurons now that are labeled in this line, and you can see that after mating and sensory exposure, there's a strong upregulation, and the cells that were active during mating are now tagged. So we tried really hard, given this information, for all the different neurons we recorded. Now we know how strongly they were activated during mating, if they were or were not expressing GFP, and try as hard as we could looking at membrane potential, at frequency, at amplitude. We were unable to find any clear relationship between the amount of activation during the learning experience and the properties of the neurons. Which again was a little bit disappointing and or perplexing, but on the other hand, maybe a little bit more interesting than simply confirming on the existing model. Right, so then we thought that the acid test at this point would really be, okay, now that we have evidence for upregulated inhibition, is this really acting to suppress the output of the mitral cells? So here are two examples that give you the answer in a nutshell. So we've got a cell from a naive animal, and you can see we're injecting current, the cell fires, we have a spike train. Here's a cell from a mated animal, and it has almost exactly the same response, and the pool data looks very much like this. So we had really, in the first time we injected current into these cells, we had very little change, if any, in their properties. So then we were left with a bit of a puzzle to explain. So Yuan Gao, the postdoc who was doing these experiments, is a crack electrophysiologist and, of course, you know, averages lots of trials to, you know, get better signal noise. So when she does this over 10 trials in naive animals, then the cells respond essentially the same time, essentially the same way every time. So the surprise to us, I hope. Oh, this is the best. This is the best part. There we go. So what we were surprised to see was when we looked at the cells in the mated animals, even though their responses were initially approximately the same, when we tested these neurons repetitively, so we drive them with 10 trials of current injection, then their responses drop off really markedly over time. So if we pool that data here, you can see on average, you know, there's a little bit of variability, but the cells in the naive animals essentially maintain the responses over time when tested with repetitive stimuli, whereas the cells in the mated group drop off quite dramatically. In some cases, their firing essentially disappears. And we can quantify this with a sort of a simple index of the initial, the final firing rate divided by the initial firing rate. And again, the red distribution is quite different. So we wanted to understand a little bit more about why the cells are losing the responsiveness. So when we looked at the naive animals, now I'm blowing this up and I'm just showing you sort of the initial part of the stimulation. So the cells are firing versus spikes here. And if you look at the resting membrane potential across the 10 trials, then it stays essentially the same. Whereas if we look at the mated animals, you can see that the membrane potential drops off pretty precipitously over the repeated trials to the point where the cell stops firing entirely. And again, here's the pool data. So we get a little bit of hyperpolarization in the naive animals, but up to 6 or 7 millivolts of this effect in the mated animals. So then this brings us to our last animal. So we have a really interesting phenomenon where now these cells, after mating, a subset of cells are acquiring this really striking history dependence, where their responses change over time. So we wanted to, again, look at this idea of whether this effect is selectively expressed in the cells that represent the learn cue, the pheromones of the stud male. So in this case, our ARC-GFP animals really didn't give very good labeling of the mitral cells, so instead we used a FOS-GFP line, which gave similar results. So there's low levels of labeling in naive animals, and after mating and sensory exposure, you can see there's a subset of mitral cells that are labeled. So we've tagged now the cells that represent the stud male. And if we record now from these cells, we get a similar phenomenon where in the neurons that are unlabeled, and for the neurons that are labeled, their initial responses are very, very similar. Here's our pooled data. So even though there's a really striking difference in the amount of GFP expression, both their peak firing rate and the number of action potentials that they generate is essentially the same. And again, if we look at the repeated responses of the animals without GFP, of the cells without GFP expression, then I'm now showing these as raster now. Over time, they're maintained, or some of the cells even increases. Whereas if we look at the cells that were labeled during the mating process, again, I'm showing you the first and the last trial, and you can see that the responses now acquire this history dependence where the responsiveness falls off really strikingly over time. So these are repeated once per minute. So it's 20 seconds on, 40 seconds off. We've played around a little bit with sort of different intervals and so on, and it seems to be sort of relatively independent on that, at least on the time scales we've tested. And again, you can see this effect seems to be largely due to a change in membrane potential. So these cells are hyperpolarized by sort of on average about 3 millivolts. In this case, it's about 6 millivolts of sort of progressive depolarization that appears over time. So again, now you can see the, even though the animal's been mated, now we have two different sets of cells. We've got the cells that don't represent the stud male, and their responses stay stable over time, whereas the neurons that were active during this process and presumably encode the male pheromones, now their responses fall off quite strikingly. Right, so now we've looked at a lot of traces and counted a lot of action potentials, so maybe I can plug this back into a sort of a more conceptual picture of how we're thinking about this data. So if you remember the pregnancy block phenomenon, that's the outcome, the physiological outcome of this learning process is driven by neuroendocrine changes, which presumably depend on sort of cumulative output from the AOB. So if you look at the neurons, if we plot the cumulative number of spikes over these different trials for the unimprinted cells, then this rises pretty rapidly. Whereas for the imprinted neurons, the total output over time is cut to less than half. Right, so we think that this change in excitability that appears is a really sort of useful way for the system to regulate its total output on the time scales over which neuroendocrine changes take place, which is going to be on these slow time scales of minutes to hours. So just a quick recap. So even though we set out to look for this idea of enhanced inhibition, and we did find lots of evidence for increased inhibition, but including data that I haven't shown you today, we really don't see a striking sort of increase of activity-dependent inhibitory feedback that acts on these cells. And what's more, we see no evidence for a cellular specificity that we were expecting according to this model. So instead, we see some really striking changes in the excitability of these neurons, and it has this really interesting property that it's not expressed right away, so that this means that the initial responses are essentially the same, and this change in output only appears when the system is stimulated over time. So we think that this could be particularly useful for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, remember we said that this activity pattern in the AOB represents, say, this individual. So if we were to simply, you know, right off the bat, shut down the output of these neurons, then if another individual comes along who has a sort of overlapping chemosensory profile, then this is going to interfere with the neural representation for that individual. So the fact that the initial responses are the same, that means that if, you know, sort of Bob has been imprinted and now Sam comes along, when Sam first comes along, there's going to be no interference effect. And again, we also think that this means that having the initial responses be the same means that the sort of rapid sensory information that might trigger sort of initial behavioral responses, sensory recognition of an individual, all this information is still there in a relatively undisturbed form when the animals, say, first encounter each other. But during these late periods, the sensitivity of the system is lowered, and this means that on these timescales of minutes to hours again, that means that the pheromones of the imprinted individual are going to have a much reduced effect on neuroendocrine status, which can account for the lack of pregnancy block that's triggered by the male chemo signals. So I'll leave things there. I really want to acknowledge Yuan Gao, who's the postdoc who did the vast majority of this work, all the other folks in the lab who've contributed to this along the way, and collaborators, especially Steve and Yoram, who really got us involved in this work, and of course the folks who have funded this along the way. So thanks a lot. I'd be happy to take any questions.
So thanks, Ian. That's fun. So I like a lot of what you've presented, especially the sort of skeptical role that you're taking about the models, you know, that have been developed before too. Because I very much concur with your view that there's so much we still don't understand about this. Another comment I'll just simply make is that while we never published it, we did some modeling very early on, which actually suggested that modulations of membrane potential might be actually a more specific way to learn a specific odor than synaptic changes, and that's very much consistent with what you're showing there. And of course, I mean, the experimental part of that is infinitely more important than the conceptual one, but I think it fits nicely with that. The things that I sort of found I had questions about were a couple of things. So first of all, was there anything in your experiments that discriminated the possibility that the stimulus was simply picking out a special population of mitral cells that, for example, were harder to record from and sort of lost membrane potential over the duration of the recording, for example, right? So, for instance, you know, following up on that, do you know that the stimulus pulses that you're giving, are those actually critical for this temporal decline in the membrane potential, or does that happen even if you don't hit them with current injections throughout the duration of your recording? And then a final one I'll throw out there is, do these neuronal populations start out with different membrane potentials from each other? Because the prediction is of course that any sort of plasticity changes that are going on were already underway before you cut your slices, and so you might naively expect that the initial membrane potential of these cells would already be lower. It would be, you know, something of a coincidence that you just happened to catch them right at the very beginning of this process, for example, right?
Right. So I guess a comment and two questions. In response to the comment, yeah, I mean, in some ways it seems like a simpler solution if we're trying to produce a cell-specific change in output, just simply changing the excitability of that specific cell rather than coordinating all these, you know, thousand synapses, synaptic inputs, is potentially a simpler solution. And, you know, I mean, even going back to sort of very early sort of invertebrate sensory learning paradigms, if you have like a if you have a sensory pathway that tends to produce this sort of stereotype response that's, you know, linked to one thing and nothing else, then this is maybe the simplest way to modulate that. So the second question, I think, was whether or not this is just capturing a specific population of cells that already has this sort of property intrinsically, and we're not generating it, we're just unveiling it somehow. I don't think that that's something that we can necessarily rule out now. So one thing that we don't see a great deal of labeling with sensory exposure alone. It seems to require mating to take place, but that doesn't necessarily address your point. So one thing that we'd love to be able to do, it's sort of the limitation of the tagging approach right now. We'd love to be able to do two colors of labeling and expose to one stimulus and have one you know, labeled, say, by exposure alone and the other by the actual sort of mating experience, which is presumably inducing the plasticity that we're seeing. So I'll keep you posted. We have our fingers crossed. We've just got a couple animals to work with now. So we'll see what happens there. As far as the process being already set in motion versus sort of initial potentials of these cells, we found that the initial resting potential looks like it's the same, and then it's the addition on average across our sample of cells, and it's actually the addition of activity that drives it down. It's one caveat to that is that we do see, you know, depending on what internal solution we're using, we see a, we presume it's a dialysis effect where the potential drops a little bit. So if we do let that sort of, you know, asymptote and then add activity on top of that, then we do still see this change specifically in the neurons that we've tagged. So yeah, hopefully this will let us get a handle on the actual sort of mechanism that is causing the cells to hyperpolarize. So we're also trying to chase that down, which has been kind of a swamp of pharmacology.
In the main bulb, a few action potentials in the mitral cell will give you nice dendrodendritic inhibition. And here, if I'm remembering correctly, you needed to wait tens of seconds before you saw anything.
Right, or I'd say it starts to manifest inside of a second or two pretty clearly. So it seems to sort of appear cumulatively, and it has a greater effect later in the train. But I'd say it doesn't take 10 seconds to appear, but it appears under these.
Whatever it is, it takes significantly longer, and I can think of a number of complicated models for why that might be. But do you have a sense of what underlies a very slow accumulation of inhibition?
Yeah, Nathan Urban's lab has shown that there's activating mGluRs can drive a really strong upregulation of GABA release. So this would be one model, would be that you need sort of higher levels of activity if it's acting specifically on the postsynaptic spine. I think they show that it elevates resting calcium or something like that. So that's our operating model right now. We've played a little bit with mGluR pharmacology as well, and so there's some still some experimental things to sort out there, but it looks suspiciously like this might be the effect. So maybe we need to get spillover, say, to extrasynaptic mGluRs or something like that at higher activity levels to drive the phenomenon. I guess we could try with some sort of low affinity blockers or something to try and sort that out. But again, sort of swamp of pharmacology we're trying to skirt a little bit.
I just have a small technical question that you may have addressed and I just missed. I was wondering when you did your recordings relative to the matings, right? Because there's this, because as you mentioned, there's a strong temporal component to this, and that the first 4 hours, the Bruce effect doesn't even take place, and then there's this limit of when implantation occurs, right? So have you played with that timing, and when did you do it?
We haven't really. So our timing for the labeling window, at least, is still, you know, we had got sort of call it 2 hours after the 4 hour imprinting period or so before the labeling starts to go away. So we're constrained a little bit, although it just struck me, as you said that, one experiment we really should do is let them mate, but then remove the male right after so there's no sensory exposure. So in that case, presumably we'll still have labeling, but without the sensory component.
Test within that 4 hour window where you can still swap so that it was strange and get no bruise.
So we haven't played with different strains or, you know, recording at different time periods and so on. This is a topic that's surfaced. I mean, Yuan, as these experiments get very involved, and she's done a lot of recordings, so I've pushed on that point a little bit, but only so far, I think.
So I have, sure. I have a question here. You're talking about the glutamate. Did you try pharmacology on the biogenic amine? Because this area really innervated by the noradrenaline. And is this can be
Right, exactly. And I think there's already some experiments locally infusing blockers for noradrenaline or activators of noradrenergic receptors. And I believe the literature shows that blocking noradrenergic inputs will prevent the formation of the memory, whereas it can be mimicked by activating receptors. So yeah, there's already a sort of a really established body of work that implicates these and potentially other sort of neuromodulatory systems. So I think I mentioned early on, we got involved with this actually working with Steve Shea. And I think these are exactly some of the questions that he's planning to ask is, you know, exactly how does noradrenergic input create a window that's amenable for plasticity.
In the main olfactory bulb, and Didier's lab and Pierre Marie Yeo's lab have both talked about the role of adult neurogenesis in some of these very acute learning situations. Any thoughts on the AOB and the Bruce effect?
It's a really interesting angle, the fact that we see increased frequency, you know, that could be sort of neatly and tidily explained if we were bringing, say, new granule cells or, for instance, new spines into the circuit. Yeah, I guess so. That's another set of conditions that we could potentially manipulate. So if we could block neurogenesis and see whether we still see the same kinds of physiological effects, or I don't know what the data is on blocking neurogenesis and actually looking at the pregnancy block itself, but that would be sort of a nice parallel experiment as well.
I wasn't thinking so much of blocking neurogenesis, but whether there's any temporal relationship between recently born granule cells in the AOB and whether those are being preferentially involved in the kinds of events you're taking a look at.
Right. So that would be an interesting experiment if we could somehow, you know, tag those in a different kind of way and then look at the newborn cells and how they're recruited by activity. So I guess the evidence in the main bulb and also in the, say, in the dentate is that the younger neurons will be more excitable and, you know, more subject to plasticity. So I guess they would, in that sense, they would be, you know, pretty strong candidates for that.
So mate recognition happens in both male and female mice. And here you have a behavior correlate that's for the female. So do you think the same thing can happen in the male AOB?
Naturally, this is also a question that's come up in the lab. And we're very interested in that. This was sort of a natural starting point, I think, because there's a, you know, an established body of literature and there's the physiological effect of the pregnancy block. So we started there. There's no real, I guess the Coolidge effect would be a good place to look. We're interested in sort of seeing whether these similar mechanisms are at play in other, you know, paradigms. You know, male-male aggression would be another candidate. You know, if there are sort of ongoing changes in physiology in the AOB that are responsible for phenomena like that.
So which aspects of mating is causing this plasticity? I mean, is it obviously chemical, but also this, you know, somewhat sensory stimulation, or maybe sperm? I mean, what are the causal, you know, stimulation?
So it seems to depend on the coincidence of, I guess, the noradrenaline released by mating.
Right, but when you say mating, I mean.
Oh, right, so. Steve might be able to respond to that better than I can, but I think the sort of vaginocervical stimulation is one of the critical events that actually drives the, you know, neuromodulatory changes that create the plasticity window. So then sort of that event. I'm sure there are other sensory components, you know, sort of visual, auditory potentially, or the fact that there's The mounting behavior might produce some out of sensory inputs that contribute to that as well. And then sort of, I guess, my hand wavy response would be sort of the combination of all of those coincident with the sensory input.
Thank you very much. And so we're a little early, and because we started a little early, and you went very, very efficiently. So we'll just we move now to the break, and then be back here at 4 promptly. Move slowly to the break, and we'll be there by 4. Be there in 5 minutes, but be back here on the dot of 4 for Lisa's talk.